This is the audio that goes with NPM Builders versus Dwyer. And so in Brown versus Voss, we were asking whether or what can be considered kind of misuse of an easement. And we get a sense of a fairly strict, at least, statement of the law. You can only use the easement kind of for what it's identified for, not beyond it. Although we saw that the injunction side, there was a little bit of variance there because we allowed Brown to still do what he did as long as he didn't kind of materially change the scope of the usage. We're going to see this kind of continue here where we initially have this idea of, look, the easement is what the easement is, but the law starts to flex it some as long as the benefit and burden balance is basically the same. And so here we've got the defendant is Leslie Dwyer. He owns a parcel of land. If we look here on the top of view here, Dwyer's house is this house, like kind of basically right at the corner, the right corner over on the left part of your screen. It's that house that's sitting there. And essentially, you're going to go into a new development that NPM Builders was trying to build at the time. And you can already see if you take a look at the top of Dwyer's house that he's got this circular driveway, and there's basically multiple ways to get into it. And so when Dwyer purchases this land in the deed he has, he basically has a right-of-way along the cartway to Pine Street, basically across NPM's land. The cartway branches, so it provides Dwyer access to his property at three separate points. If you zoom down to street view, you can see these three different ways in which you can kind of get into his property from Pine Street, which is that street there on the left. And so essentially NPM is about to go in. Wait, let me step back. And so there, basically what you have is Dwyer is a affirmative easement, right? He's the dominant. NPM Builders owns the servient land, and it's a right of way. It's this kind of right of ingress and egress along these cart paths, right, which essentially are these three separate points that attach to Pine Street. And NPM's going to basically develop out the part that you see here on the south part of it. And when they're going to develop this out, they need to move one of those connection points, those right-of-ways, to Pine Street. And so there, the servient landowner, we've got this appurtenant easement both on the benefit and burden side. And NPM wants to move the location of the easement. And Dwyer's response essentially is, hey, the easement says what the easement says. The easement is at these three points. You can't do anything about it, right? And NPM is here seeking a declaratory judgment for the court to declare that they can move it in some ways. And the reason they're pushing for this change in location is because they're pushing some change in the law that as long as some requirements are met, servient landowners, servient in the easement sense, should be able to move and change the location of an easement. And the trial court judge here, taking a look at it and seeing what's going on, says, you know what, I'm bound by the law. The law is that as once the location of an easement's been fixed, it can't be changed unless you guys would agree to it. And here Dwyer won't agree, or my bet most likely Dwyer won't agree for a monetary amount that's reasonable to NPM. And so NPM as a developer is going to ask the court for permission to change the location. And also broader than this, right, is in Massachusetts where this court is, probably wants the law to be changed because they're a developer, they're other developers, they're going to run into these situations where they don't want to get rid of an easement, they just want to modify the easement's location so they can use the property that's burdened in a different way. And so if you go to the next slide, we get a sense of how both the third restatement and a lot of courts that follow this variation of the common law, where once the easement's where it is, it's fixed. But jurisdictions now, just like Massachusetts, have adopted this, where they allow, and then I'm just reading from both the case and actually slide two, allow normal use or development of the servient estate. The key here is that we're allowing a change to the burden property, not the benefited property, but only if the changes do not. And so this is like the opposite of Brown versus Voss. Right now we're looking at it through the lens of, if, let's assume Voss wanted to change the location of his easement. I can make the changes if they don't, as long as they don't do these things. And there's an or here, so any of these. As long as they don't significantly lessen the utility of the easement, basically reduce the benefit to the dominant property, increase the burdens on the owner of the easement in its use and enjoyment. Again, we're going to the benefit here. Or frustrate the purpose for which the easement was created. Again, going to the benefit. We don't really need to concern ourselves with the burden because it's the burdened property owner that's making the change. And we're just going to infer that they're making a change that reduces the burden. And here, the Massachusetts Supreme Court adopts this standard and actually pushes it back down to the lower court to make this determination, right? Does changing this connection of one of these three points of connection to Pine Street, does it make sure it doesn't do any of these things? It doesn't significantly lessen the utility of the easement. It can lessen it a little bit. It doesn't increase the burden, can't increase the burden at all, right? Or frustrate the purpose for which the easement was created. Here, access. My gut here is it's probably not going to be hard for the developer to prove that making this change, as long as the access point is the same size. If you look at Dwyer's property, he's got a nice curved driveway, circular driveway. He'll be able to do what he wants to do. Then there's some other open questions. So if I'm a servant property owner, I'd like to move what I've been doing. Do I have to pay for it? Yeah, it makes sense, right? The benefited property owner is the one that might be affected a little bit in some way. And if the burden one's the one that wants to do something, then I'm the one that's going to have to pay for it. So the burden property owner is going to have to pay for it. And then I have this question of, okay, well, do I have to ask first? Put a different way, could NPM Builders basically change the location and then push the burden on Dwyer to sue and say, hey, you didn't meet any of these requirements. It actually does burden me in some way. That's not the way it works. NPM Builders basically has to ask. The hope is he asks Dwyer, and Dwyer and him, particularly in light of this rule being adopted, come to their own agreement. Right, so NPM approaches Dwyer and says, look, as you know, in the state of Massachusetts, I can move the location as long as these requirements are met, that none of these burdens or increase in burden or significant lessen happen. So Dwyer, how about here? The only time I've got to go to a court is if it turns out I ask, Dwyer says no, says, okay, well, I'm going to a court now to get a declaratory judgment, essentially a statement by the court that I can do this. Finally, right, there's this question, what about the ability to prevent this from happening? It turns out that I can, in the original easement document, put a no change clause in. That is, if the original document expressly prohibits relocating the easement, then I'll never be able to go to a court. Clearly, I could get together as the burdened property owner with the benefited property owner, and we could work something out. We can always work something out in writing as a change, right? But if I've got a no change clause in there, a court's never going to step in. The theory here being is if I've got a no change clause, the servient or burdened property should get a lot more for it because now I know that thing is stuck where it is, and I can't get this thing changed unless the burden, the dominant or benefited property owner decides that that's okay. So the question then becomes, right, what other options do I have? We'll talk about this a little more in the next slide, but this is our questions of how do we terminate an easement or potentially modify it in some way beyond what we were talking about here. So we could do this, and I'm going to go ahead and go to the next slide. Actually, go to the next slide, which is slide. I should have numbered these, as I should have always numbered these. Slide three. Gosh, only four of these. Easiest way to terminate it is either for NPM to just buy Dwyer's property, and then I would own both the benefited and burdened property, and you can't have an easement on your own property, and it goes away. We could cut a deal, but it sounds like we couldn't cut a deal here. Or we could get a situation where Dwyer has abandoned his easement, maybe one of those connections he doesn't use. He's never used it in some way, and I could go to a court and say, look, I don't need to worry about that connection anymore because he doesn't use that right of way. He's never used that in that right of way. In some ways, this would be not necessarily like adverse possession in that I, as the dominant the servant property owner, need to be adversely possessing the dominant property owner, but it would be something where I would say, look, the dominant property owner is not using it at all. We could also have estoppel, and this would be essentially the reverse of an easement by estoppel, or essentially a termination of an easement by estoppel. I start moving it myself. He doesn't say anything about it. I make some improvements based on that. He's a stop from complaining. We could also adverse possess it the other way. So this, instead of an easement by prescription, it'd be the opposite. Or I could seek condemnation from the locality, essentially get them to pay Dwyer, but force him to change the location that's there. And so that would be our other options of getting rid of this, is through some termination methodology. And that kind of goes through the different ways in which we could have a termination of an easement that are described in 452 and 453 of the casebook. I'm going to go back up to slide two. And so here's this hypothetical, and here the hypothetical is going to change things around a little bit. And here we're going to have the dominant property owner. They're the ones that have a right of way. Here it's an affirmative right to conduct railroad service over a stretch of land. And they would like to change it, to change the usage in some way, to now create a system of nature trails. Easiest way would have been for the railroad to just buy the land outright, own it by itself, but instead here it only has an easement. And thus, the question becomes if the change would exceed the easement scope, right? And then that means the person who owns the property could sue and say that they can't do that, that's there. And we've got the same kind of same push-pull between the two that we saw in Brown versus Voss, right? So some courts would say, look, the easement is what the easement is. Other courts would say, look, as long as the usage isn't anything more, and here actually it looks like it might be less, right? Instead of a railroad, we've got a nature trail. We might allow that change in usage to vary there. And so you're going to see jurisdictions vary on whether we can do that. The one thing about this versus what's happening in NPM versus Dwyer is that here it's the dominant person, and it's actually an in-gross dominant that's looking to change the nature of the easement. And courts are very wary about that, although we see some courts will allow it to happen. See Brown versus Voss. Okay, so back now to slide three. We talked about terminations of easements. Easiest way is just to get an agreement to terminate or basically buy the property that's up there. But what about transferring an easement? Right? Now, one of the ways we know that easements get transferred is if it's an appurtenant easement, the transfer happens when the dominant estate is transferred. For example, if Dwyer sells his house to me, I get the benefit now as the owner of the property of the easement. What happens if I buy Dwyer's property and I break it up into smaller parcels, right? So this is the second hypothetical here. B buys the property, decides to break it up into all these smaller pieces that are there. And in those scenarios, at least, the subdivided actually succeed in the privileges to use the property, that is, still use the right-of-way, etc. It does matter, though, whether the amount of usage is just dramatically different or not. And so in those situations, we might be concerned. But the theory here is that the property itself acts as some ways a limiter on the burden, right? That is, the more parcels that are on there, it's still the same size. And so we think that the burden would be the same. But we still have this foreseeability requirement, and basically that's the extent of the added burden. Was it foreseeable or not? That would come into play. So what about easements in gross? So these are ones in which the benefited person isn't tied to a piece of property, but it's actually tied to just an individual. The modern view is that easements in gross are transferable. The one thing is these are going to be transferred not by selling property, but essentially just a transfer from one person to another. So I, let's say, paid for a right-of-way across a beach as an individual. I've got an easement now. There's a burden property. It's an affirmative easement. Can I transfer it to someone else? And in general, the view is that it's transferable. Whether I can devise an easement in gross is difficult, mainly because I don't have the limitation of the property anymore, basically how big or wide the property is, to kind of cabin the concerns that I might have. And so in that type of scenario, there are a lot of jurisdictions that say, listen, easements in gross are only divisible to the extent that they don't lead to any excess burden on the servient tenement. And it really depends on the circumstances that surround them. And so here we're even more concerned than we are in the kind of a pertinent type of scenario. Okay, now on to slide four. This is where I want to talk about negative easements. I don't know if you've noticed, but all the easements that we've talked about in this chapter and when talking about easements have been affirmative easements. Turns out the reason we've done that is because courts in the United States rarely recognize negative easements. Actually, they only recognize negative easements if they fall in these four categories. That is, an easement to prevent somebody from blocking the windows to my house or building. That would be a negative easement. The dominant property owner gets to prevent the servient property owner from doing something. Interfering with airflow to your land in a defined channel, right? So this would be kind of blocking the ability for air to flow across my farm or maybe my wind farm, let's say. Removing lateral support. Don't dig so deep right next to my property that my property ends up kind of falling over, right? I can prevent you from doing that. And then finally, interfering with the flow of an artificial stream. So you couldn't build a dam or something that would block an artificial stream coming to my property. These are the only four kind of recognized easements, negative easements in the United States. And it shows you how limited it is, right? The fact that we've got an ability to create easements, affirmative easements, pretty much anything we want to do, but with negative easements, it's only these four that are recognized. The other kind of caveat to this is that we might have statutory availability for easements, and so an example of this is a conservation easement, where I could buy a property and then give it to someone, but create a negative easement saying you can't develop the property commercially, or you can't cut the trees on the property, etc. We're going to find out that what's going to fill this void, this space, is going to be negative covenants or restrictive covenants, which we will talk about in the next virtual class.